to the brightest audience in the country. This is Jason Troyer, filling in for Bob Inyart, America's most popular self-proclaimed right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. And I am getting ready to go to Israel. We have the flight itinerary. I'm trying to get time off of work. We're working all the details out. It's going to be great. Today's sermon, we're going to talk about astronomy and the stars and the planets and how they interact. And I took astronomy in college. I got an A in it because it was easy. And the stuff that I learned in this sermon is far more important than I learned in an entire semester of astronomy. In astronomy, the teacher, he would go on about celebrating the different phases of the sun. And he would just love that stuff. And he would ask you very difficult questions like, if you were looking through a telescope and you saw a comet approaching the Earth and it was going to strike the Earth, would you tell people or wouldn't you? I mean, that was pretty much the gist of the astronomy class. It was just complete. There wasn't science to it at all. And you learned some of the constellations and whatever. Well, anyway, I was one of his favorite students in class because I was a smart aleck. And you don't have to know anything in college. You just have to... The teacher has to like you. So when he asked if you saw a comet coming towards the Earth and it was going to impact the Earth and would you tell anybody? And we had to write it down on a piece of paper and hand it in, and he thought I had the best answer. I said, I wouldn't tell anybody because if I'm right, then everybody's dead, and if I'm wrong, I'm dead. And he got a kick out of it, and he gave me an A. And that's, you know, pretty much the whole class. But you will actually learn something cool in this sermon. Now, Bob used a lot of visuals, so if you don't live in Denver, you're going to miss out on a little bit. But that's one reason you should visit Denver or move to Denver. But you should still be able to get quite a bit out of this sermon because it's what the science teachers never told you. So let's listen in to astronomical evidence.
Psalm 19, I have a question. Who has attended school? Who here in this room has attended school or some kind of formal classes any time in the last two decades, in the 80s or 90s? Okay, wow, 60% or more. And of those of you who raised your hand, have any of you studied science? In the last two decades, any science classes? Science? Okay, now we're down to about 40%. Okay, have any of you taken any astronomy classes? Anything about astronomy in the last 20 years? Okay, all right, pretty good. We're up still 25%. Okay, so you've been taught about the solar system and the nine planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, all that, right? Which of the nine planets of the solar system were you taught was farthest from the sun? Could somebody shout out? You guys are all wrong. Either you're wrong or your teacher was wrong. Because for the last 20 years, Neptune has been farthest from the sun. Because Pluto has a weird orbit. It's eccentric. And most of the orbits of the planets are pretty circular for the most part, and they lie in a similar plane. But Pluto goes way out there, and it comes back sort of close to the sun, then it goes way out again, and for 20 years of its orbit, it's closer to the sun than Neptune is. It takes 248 years for Pluto to go around the sun one time. So since the Earth was created, it's been around the sun about 25 times. And it's just last year it crossed past Neptune's orbit, so it's now the farthest planet again. And it will be so for the next 228 years. So if you go back to school and you have a test, you can feel free to put Pluto's farthest planet. But for the last 20 years, it's been Neptune. But now that's changed once again. Psalm 19. Critics have claimed that Psalm 19, people who don't believe in God, or at least they don't like the Bible, They've claimed that Psalm 19 was not inspired by the Lord, and that an editor, a rather unskilled editor, took two separate pieces of poems and stuck them together, and that became Psalm 19. They point out the severe disjoint between the first and second halves of this short little poem, this song. Up to verse 7 speaks of astronomical things. And there, through the end, verse 14, speaks of the scriptures. So they say, well, some guy, some redactor, he took one part, a few verses, and he took something else and he stuck them together because he needed a psalm. And he said, there's one. And it really is totally, it doesn't even make sense sticking it together like that. The beginning of the psalm speaks of the heavens, and the second half speaks of the Word of God. If you let your eyes scan through the first half, you'll see the words heavens, firmament, day, night, earth, world, sun, circuit, that is the orbit, and heat, the heat of the sun. That's all about the solar system. The second half, we read of the law, convert, testimony, statutes, right, commandments, judgments, words, mouth, meditation. That's all about words and the Word of God. So, unbelievers have argued, we have two unrelated chunks of literature feebly stuck together without a good transition. But consider this. The first half of this psalm describes the heavens, yes, but in literary terms. It uses terms that we would use if we were analyzing a piece of literature, like a play, or a drama, or a book. So it speaks of the solar system using the terms of the literary critic. And the second half describes the word, the Bible, using astronomical terms. Now, if that's true, that ties the two halves together, and it shows that they're not separate or disjoint, but they're one by one author. That this psalm, this poem, set to music, was not randomly thrown together, but was fashioned by an intelligent designer. Now let's read this psalm, and halfway through, we'll look at a few slides, a slideshow. As we read the first half of the psalm, we will notice the literary terms used to describe the heavens, which speak of the gospel. The heavens tell the gospel to mankind. That's what the Bible says. Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Now that word declare, that's a declarative statement, right? And declare, that's words. The firmament shows the handiwork. Firmament is the expanse. And that word show means to tell or declare. That's how it's used. The first use is in Genesis 3 when God said, who told you that you were naked? It's that same verb there. So these are words to describe the heavens that are very verbal and literary oriented. Look at the second verse. Day unto day utters speech. You see the point? The first half that's about the solar system is all about words. Because God wrote two books. One you could bind and buy off a printer, and it's the Bible. And the other book is the universe, the solar system, and our world. He wrote that book too, only he made it three-dimensional. And the words are pictures and living creatures and stars and planets. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. So when we look at the way the sun and the earth move in conjunction to one another, in the moon, in the planets, that should teach us something. Well, what should it teach us? What could astronomy possibly teach us? Because these things are far away. Now, what could we possibly learn from them? There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. There's four verbal elements in that one verse, right? It's talking about the planets and the sun and the moon, but there's no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. The literary terms. And verse 4, their line has gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. In them, he has set a tabernacle for the sun. Now, what does that mean, their line? Well, in three versions that I'm aware of, they translate that their voice. That's in the Septuagint, the Syriac, and the Latin Vulgate. It's their voice has gone out throughout all the earth. In other words, the light, either from the stars or the sun or reflected off the planets, come to the earth. So their line, and they do come, the starlight hits us, right? And it has gone out throughout all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. So everyone who's lived has seen the stars and the sun and the moon. Well, except for the few people, tragically, who are blind. But even they have been told about what these points of light out in the sky, what they look like and what they're doing. In them, in among those stars and those points of light, God has set a tabernacle for the sun. Now, what does that mean, a tabernacle? A tabernacle is a tent. That's where people used to live, in tents. That was their house. Their house, the house of Israel, was a tent. They lived in tents. And God lived in a tent initially. The tabernacle was God's house. And we say that the sun, we talk about the house of the rising sun, and that the sun goes through the houses of the zodiac. And this is where this idea comes from, because God built a house for the sun, just like he built a heaven for us. And he built mansions or houses for us that we will dwell in. And Christ dwells in the center of a heaven that we will live in. And the sun he put in the center of this big house that he made for us to dwell in, the solar system. Verse 5. And the sun is like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber and rejoices like a strong man to run its race. Its rising is from one end of heaven and its circuit to the other end. And there is nothing hidden from its heat. And the idea of hidden, that word could also be translated secret. And it's more of an idea of communication than of physics or, you know, things don't hide, but we tend to hide things. Sometimes we hide a message. And God hid a message in the planets and in the stars. And we've covered that in the past. But right now, I'd like us to look at this is the current edition of Newsweek. And we see John Ashcroft on the cover, Holy War. But I want to look at a different Holy War within the pages of this magazine. Of course, John Ashcroft is W's appointee for nominee for Attorney General, and we pray that he does a good job. Unfortunately, pro-life leaders seem to think it's okay to nominate and recommend pro-abortion judges. We don't know why so many pro-life leaders do that. I realize this is a slight tangent, but you like to think that if a judge supported, let's say, killing black people, that George W. Bush or John Ashcroft would say, well, he's disqualified because he supports killing black people. But if a judge supports killing babies, then our leaders seem to think they're perfectly fine as judges. I don't understand that myself. But anyway, we want to look at a different holy war in this magazine. There's an article in here about the most recent discoveries in astronomy. What can astronomy possibly teach us about God? But we're going to see if we can figure this out. I'd like to read some quotes out of this Newsweek article, January 22nd, 2001. You know, whenever scientists discover something, not whenever, but so frequently, they say that this blows all of our theories out of the water. How many times have you heard that in your life? I have heard it frequently. And we see that phrase in this article. Okay, they say that there are two newly discovered and bizarre planetary systems that astronomers have found. Now, we know our sun is a star and has planets orbiting around it, and we call that a solar system, and it's planets. And up until 1995, we didn't have any hard evidence, or really any evidence, that there might be other planets outside of our solar system. But now they've found about 50 different stars where they're too far away to see a planet, but they could measure the wobble of the star. And they see that the stars are wobbling the way our star wobbles based on how the planets revolve around it. And when all the planets are lined up on one side, like they were back about 3 years ago in the late 90s, they can see a wobble in the sun, very distinct. And so they look at stars that are farther away, and they say, we can tell that this star has two planets around it. And we could tell, and we even know how long they take to orbit, because we can measure the wobble of the star. Now, that's fascinating, and science will continue to develop and progress, and we'll test these theories, but it looks pretty good. But what they say is that these two planetary systems are clearly bizarre. Now, bizarre doesn't seem to be a normal word you'd use for science, right? Well, this chemical reaction is bizarre. That's a word you would use for the development of a plot twist. Well, that was bizarre. Look at that. Look who got the girl. That's ridiculous. How did he get her? That might be bizarre, but how could a planet be bizarre? Well, we'll look. They found two solar systems with orbiting stars just recently, and one of them, in fact, it's in the constellation Serpens. There's a star in this constellation that is huge. I think it's 17 times larger than Jupiter. I'm sorry, the planet. Let me say this again. In the constellation Serpens, they have found a star that has a planet orbiting around it, and it's huge. The largest planet in our system is Jupiter, and it is a massive planet. Well, this planet that they have found is 17 times larger than Jupiter, and it's very close to the star, very close indeed. Now, I'll show you a picture of the star that they're looking at, Gliese 876. It's right in the middle there. And by studying that star, now that's not nearly as far as the vast majority of stars in our universe. This star, the light from that star, takes 123 years to reach us. But the problem, and the reason they said this is clearly bizarre, is because there's a massive planet, 17 times bigger than Jupiter, and it's real tight close in to the star. It's real close to the star. And they say that throws our whole theory in ruins as to how planets form. Because if a star is forming, and the star is big and powerful and has a lot of gravity, and if there's as much mass as this, the star would suck it in, or they shouldn't form separately. It doesn't make any sense. So they say it's clearly bizarre. And around another star, they found two planets whose orbits are in almost perfect harmony. Now, here's what they mean by that. The one planet revolves around the star once, while the other one revolves around it twice. And they call that a resident orbit. And so the one goes around once, while the other goes around twice, and they're timed perfectly. And let me read you a quote from an astronomer at Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley. His name is Marcy, Jeffrey Marcy. He said, both of these systems are quite unique and a little frightening. Why would he say a planet is 123 light years away, so many trillions of miles, almost a quadrillion miles away? Why would he say that planet is frightening? How could an astronomer say that? Is it on a collision course with Earth? And a deep impact is going to come true? That's not it. It's frightening because why would two planets revolve, orbit a star in perfect harmony? While one goes around once, the other goes around exactly twice. What would make that happen? If they just formed by an explosion, then a contraction, what are the chances that it wouldn't be like that? Well, they're almost infinite, the points along their orbits. And it's bizarre that that occurs. And so they say it's almost frightening. And then Newsweek editorializes, and they say, astronomers tend to break out in a cold sweat when something doesn't fit their theory. And I've noticed that that is true. Because there are things that astronomers are finding out that suggest that God created the universe by speaking it into existence. This astronomer at Berkeley says, I call it a mystery object. We never expected nature would make such a gargantuan planet and so close to its star, for that matter. Now, I'd like to talk about this, the planet, the two planets that have harmonious orbits. The one goes around its star once, while the other twice. The one planet takes 30 days to make the trip, and the other 60 days. Now, have we seen anything like that anywhere else in the universe? Well, let's take a look at the largest planet in our solar system, and it's Jupiter. Jupiter has four moons that Galileo discovered, and then other smaller rocks that are orbiting it. But of those four moons, one is Io. It's very close in. And it's moving around Jupiter relatively quickly. Io is it's a smaller moon. And what's interesting about Io is it's a rock. I think I'm trying to estimate the size of Io. Way less than the size of Texas, I believe. And it supposedly was created 4.5 billion years ago, which would mean even if it was created out of molten rock, rock that was on fire, by now it would be cold and dead and hard. But we flew a spaceship out past Io, and it took this picture of a volcano erupting on the surface of Io. And that flipped out the evolutionists. Over and over and over, they say, this throws our theories out the window. We have to start over. Well, how could there be a fire still burning 4.5 billion years later? There shouldn't be. It should be dead and cold. But if it was only created by God 6,000 years ago, then it's more than large enough to maintain a molten core and still be hot. Now, other than Io, the planet Jupiter has moons Europa, as we see right here. In fact, I'd like to show you a picture of the surface of Europa. This is what close-in pictures look like of that moon. And we also have another moon of Jupiter's, Ganymede and Callisto. And the interesting thing about these four moons is that they have a relationship in their orbits. Io, on the left here, imagine Io goes around Jupiter once. Well, Europa has only gone around Jupiter half. When Io goes around twice, Europa's gone around exactly once. When Ganymede has gone around Jupiter once, Europa has gone around exactly twice. Io's gone around exactly four times. In sync. In harmony. Better than a rap band. Callisto is interesting because it's almost in perfect harmony. It's just off by a smidgen to where when it goes around once around Jupiter, then Ganymede goes around twice. So that is dramatic. Now, why would Callisto be off a little bit, just a smidge, from a perfect, a harmonious orbit? Well, just a couple years ago, a massive comet called Shoemaker-Levy 9 hit the planet Jupiter, and it made direct impact with Jupiter. And as it was approaching, it passed a certain mathematical threshold, and it broke into a number of large pieces. And so if a large body approached Jupiter, it could affect one of the moons, and undoubtedly it did Callisto, and just nudged it ever so slightly off its original orbit. But we could see almost like a chord being played on a piano in a harmony, in octaves, we could see one after the other, they each doubled its neighbor's orbit. Now, how could that happen by chance? How could it be? If the two planets around a distant star are scaring them, and they say that it's clearly bizarre, how about Jupiter? And how often? Astronomers have known this for decades now. Well, for more than decades, that the moons of Jupiter have this relationship. And I say it's a startling piece of scientific information that they orbit in that way. How many of you have been taught that? And I went to public school, high school. I took general science. I loved science. I took a lot of science, astronomy. I never learned that. I never learned that. The secular textbooks I used for 8 years in grammar school, I never learned that. And if you were going to tell somebody one thing about the moons in the solar system, that seems to be the most interesting thing you could tell them of any of the moons in our solar system. And we don't teach it. Why doesn't the average kid in an astronomy class know that? It's because it's scary. It's frightening. Because for that to happen, for those four moons to orbit around Jupiter in sync like that, in harmony, shows that they were created by a god, a designer, who did it that way on purpose. What it reminds me of is a stopwatch that works in a rather sophisticated manner. Imagine the effort it takes to make the stopwatch so that the second hand will go around 60 times when the minute hand goes around once. And they both end up pointing up at the 12 at exactly the right second. Now, that seems like it'd take a little bit of work, doesn't it? That'd take a little bit of work. But in fact, it happens just like that. Now, that's the way God did it. God took Jupiter and he turned it into a chronometer, a timekeeper. And you've got a second hand, a minute hand, an hour hand, and a day hand. And the four moons are keeping... Imagine if you lived on Jupiter, it'd be a whole different ballgame. You could really figure out what's going on. Well, then we have another problem with Pluto and Neptune. Remember that I said that for 20 years, Pluto is closer to the Sun than Neptune out of 248 years. And at two points, going into that period and coming out, it crosses the orbit of Neptune. And I'd like to read something to you from an article, not in Newsweek, but Scientific American. And this Scientific American article addresses some of the latest discoveries in astronomy. This happens to be from September of 1999. In the decades since Pluto's discovery in 1930, the planet's enigma has deepened. Astronomers have found that most bodies that cross Neptune's orbit are unstable because Neptune will grab them and send them flying out of their orbit, perhaps out of the solar system, forever. So why is it that Pluto is not in danger from Neptune? If they say any body that crosses Neptune's orbit tends to be unstable and will be ejected from the solar system in a relatively short time. But the particular Neptune-crossing orbit in which Pluto travels is protected from the close approaches to the gas giant. Now, Neptune is one of the four gas giants of our solar system, and it's protected by a phenomenon called resonance libration, resonance libration. Now, what is that? Pluto makes two revolutions around the sun during the time that Neptune makes three. Exactly. Therefore, Pluto's orbit is said to be in 3-2 resonance with Neptune's. The relative motions of the two planets ensure that when Pluto crosses Neptune's orbit, it is very far away from the larger planet. In fact, the distance from the Sun to the Earth, if that's one unit, one astral unit, Neptune and Pluto, the closest they ever get is 17 AUs, astral units. 17 times further away than the Earth is from the Sun. That's the closest they ever get because they're in an orbit that is in sync perfectly. How does that happen? How does that happen? We've got God designing an ever-increasing complex system from as small as we can look with atomic microscopes to subatomic particles and to when these atoms come together in the most awesome ways and they build molecules. And molecules come together in our cells and they do such complex and intricate maneuvers that it blows us away as we learn and see what God has done in the tiny cell. So then we get into entire systems in our body. And then we get outside of the human body, which seems to be somewhere midway between a subatomic particle or a photon and the galaxies in the universe. And here is man right in the middle. And God made it all for us. And you get outside of the human body, and then there are ecosystems that all work together. In the biosphere, and in the hydrosphere, on the earth, in the water, and in the air, and on the land. And it all works. But then you get outside of the earth, and you get to the moon. And the moon revolves around the earth, and it all works. And because it's just the right distance away, the tides of the oceans are perfect to reoxygenate the waters of the oceans so that the plankton could live and give us over 90% of the world's oxygen. And the moon is not too close because then we'd have tidal waves destroying life on the continents every day. So it's just perfect. And then the sun is just the right distance to heat us so that we will not be burned alive or frozen to death. Because what if you're on the moon and you don't have the perfectly balanced atmosphere that we have on our Earth? What's the average daily temperature of the moon? About 300 degrees. How long would life on Earth last if all of a sudden it was 300 degrees during daylight hours? How long would we live, life on Earth? Any guesses? Anybody want to shout out an estimate? What if you went in your house and turned on the air conditioner? Would you live? How long would you live? Let me ask some of the young kids. If it was 300 degrees outside, you went in your house, turned on the air conditioner, how long do you think you'd live? Anybody? You wouldn't live long. Because the best air conditioners are designed to reduce the temperature 25 degrees from the outside temperature. That's pretty common. So outside is 300, inside is 275, you're toast. How long does it take to make a piece of toast? That's about how long we live. You realize how balanced life is from the subatomic particles on up through the Earth and our moon and our sun, and then not only that, but the planets and their moons and the orbits of the planets and how they're in sync. And our sun is passing through our Milky Way galaxy, and I'm thankful it's not banging into anything else. And there's movements in the dance of the planets that become the dance of the stars far beyond our galaxy that we're just beginning to become aware of, that God did it all. What an awesome design that he created. Now, I'd like to show you something else out of this article in Newsweek, January 22nd. That's tomorrow's date. Here's the constellation Leo. And what they did, they took and they've done this a number of times now recently. They've taken a powerful telescope, and they've said, we're not going to look at a large chunk of the sky. We're going to look at a little speck of the sky. And we're going to keep focused on that speck for a long time. And we can't see anything there normally. Now, in a moment, I'll show you what the photograph they've taken that's inside that circle, in a little speck of that circle. When you look at a little speck of the sky, you don't see anything. You just see darkness. Because there's not enough photons, there's not enough light for us to see stars out there. But if you keep looking, it's like your eyes getting adjusted to the darkness at night. When you go to bed and you shut off the light and you can't see anything, then a couple of minutes later you can see everything. Because enough photons are hitting in your eyes and your optics got adjusted. That's the way God made us. That's amazing too. Now you can see it. Well, they do that with a telescope and they keep focused on a dark spot. And as the photons come in, they get recorded on computer or on photographic film, but these days on computer. And then they could develop the picture. And they see what they were looking at. And here's what they predict. We're looking so far into space that we're seeing light that took 6.5 billion years to get to us. And they say the whole universe is only about 20 billion years old or so, give or take a couple billion. So that's about a third of the whole history of the universe. So they say when we look back there, we'll see galaxies just forming as they were only two-thirds of the way into the universe, not now when it's fully developed. And so here's what they see. They see what they see everywhere. But only this blew their minds because they're looking at the smallest speck, and these galaxies, they've estimated, are 6.5 billion light years away, and it's 500 million light years in diameter, this picture. 500 million light years in diameter. It's huge, and it's too big, and it's fully developed. And they say, why is that? Because it shouldn't be. Let me see if I could find some of their quotes in here. Okay, what did astronomers find? Only the largest structure ever observed in the universe. All these galaxies that they believe are gravitationally bound to one another, forming a massive structure. And they say it's about 500 million light years across. It is a cluster of galaxies, like a bunch of Milky Ways and Andromeda galaxies, each one of those specks of light, some of them multiple galaxies. And they say this, something that far away is also that long ago. So if it took the light 6.5 billion years to get here, which it didn't, God created the light in transit, but this is their theory, but these galaxies may be that far away. It could be very, very far away. But they say if it's that far away, it's also that long ago. Astronomers are seeing this as it was 6.5 billion years ago, when the universe was only about one-third its present age then. And here's a quote from another astronomer at the Optical Astronomy Observatories. That's the National Optical Astronomy Observatories, Gerard Williger. He said gravity, he's talking about this picture and about this problem. He says gravity simply wouldn't have had time to pull a structure together 500 million light years across given the age of the universe. It couldn't happen, but it did. The next heading in Newsweek, and yet, there it is. It couldn't form. Given the universe is 20 billion years old, it couldn't form. And yet, there it is. What did Marcy say? It's a little frightening. Why is it frightening? Why do they call this clearly bizarre? Why don't they just say, wow, look at that? Look at that. far, far away. There's galaxies just like we see everywhere. As far out they... In fact, I'd like to show you another picture that they went out 15 billion years in Hubble's deep field photograph. When they were... They built up this photo for weeks before it was developed. They said, we've trained the Hubble Space Telescope on one speck of the sky, and we are going to see the edge of the universe. We are going to see the galaxies that are 15 billion years old that were just forming when they were baby galaxies, and we'll see what galaxies look like when they were nascent, when they were just forming. And here's what we got. Galaxies that look like galaxies everywhere, like the Andromeda galaxy, like the Milky Way, like right next door. And it's a little frightening, said Marcy. And yet, there it is. Maybe, Newsweek writes, maybe our pet model of Genesis has some holes. There are no holes in my model of Genesis. It's got 50 chapters, and it's not been corrected to this day. And it stands the test of the progress of science. They write, cosmologists, the people who study this stuff, act all jittery when someone finds something that seems to threaten the Big Bang. It's a little frightening. I'd like to show you one more thing that doesn't come from Newsweek, but out of this American Scientific American magazine. And it's the Kuiper Belt. Who here has heard of the Kuiper Belt? Please raise your hand. Okay, just a couple studying astronomy lately. Good for you guys. Okay, the Kuiper Belt is way out in the... Well, in this picture right here, that's Pluto. So these are icy bodies that are pretty small, about maybe 1 to 100 kilometers, maybe some as much as 1,000 kilometers in diameter, but they're relatively small. But you know what they say about these bodies? Now look at that. That's a chart of where they will be. What's the date for this? In 2 days from now, I think. In 2 days from now, that is under our best current observations and computer tracking. This is a chart of where each of those bodies will be. Now, do you see anything interesting about that plot right there, that chart? I recall walking to Don and Darlene Waldron's home after a TV show back about 6 years ago. And I did the show at Channel 53 at 10 o'clock, got done at 11, and I lent somebody my car. And so we were staying at their house, right, honey? And I had to walk to the Waldron's house, and it's about 3 miles or so, 4 miles. And it was a perfectly clear night, and I was looking up at the stars, and I kept thinking, there are so many stars that seem to make shapes. And I don't mean the 12 zodiacs or the constellations. That's another fabulous Bible story. But I mean, they just seem to make shapes like equilateral triangles. Everywhere I look, I seem to see equilateral triangles of stars of relative luminosity or of a magnitude that appears about equal. I thought, I wonder why that is. If you just had a random bunch of dots of light, would they make so many nice equilateral triangles and other geometric shapes that it looked to me that was up in the sky? And I thought, well, I'll never mention that because it's obviously too stupid because nobody else mentions it, so it just must be a coincidence. Until I found this article in Scientific America and this plot right here. Because what they point out, let me read you this, about the Kuiper Belt. The distribution of these objects, which we could see the distribution, that's where they are. If you look down at the sun in the middle, that's where they are. The distribution of these objects exhibits prominent, non-random features that cannot be readily explained by the current model of the solar system. look at the way they tend to line up, like spokes in a wheel. Or like you got a tent, and these are the tent wires. Or like you're at DIA, and you see the roof, and they got the ropes holding it up. And that's the way, it's uncanny how some of them line up. Often they're in pairs or more, and they're coming out as though they were spokes from the center of a wheel. And over and over and over, they're in uncanny lines. And like we said, there have been some things in the history of the solar system that have seemed to gone awry. Some comets, perhaps because of the judgment, the flood, because of the Exodus events where comets have come and interrupted life on Earth and Jupiter. And so maybe some things are a bit out of whack as compared to how they were originally created. But look at these spokes coming out. And they're lined up so nicely. And right here, I mean, this is dramatic. If it's just random rocks from an explosion, why would they be lined up like this? How many is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, can't count them, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, all lined up in the perfect row. When I took outdoor survival at Arizona State University, they taught us if you're out in the wilderness and you're stuck and you got to make a sign to catch the pilot's eye, make straight lines, because straight lines do not occur in nature. Well, the teacher never heard of the Kuiper Belt, because they do. And so Scientific American says the distribution of these exhibits prominent non-random features that cannot be explained by our model of how the solar system was formed. What does that mean? It means that God made it. That's what it means. May God bless you guys.
Bob was saying about Psalms 19 is that the beginning of the book talks about God as the creator. And that's what Bob talked about in there. The heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork. And Bob was doing really great in the sermon. We had to kind of cut a little bit of it so we didn't get the end of the explanation. Well, the beginning of Psalms is God as the creator. And the end of Psalms 19 is God as the redeemer. Verse 7, the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. Then you could skip to the last verse. Let the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer.